Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Circuit. I am Ben Beharin.
Greetings, Internet. I am Jay Goldberg.
So it was another interesting and also somewhat busy week in the world of semiconductors. A number of kind of juicy nuggets of news came out. So we'll briefly sort of talk through those, some of the implications, and then also kind of tie it all together with some discussions on market sizing and what that means for competition. But hot off the first presses, Google announced their very not so secret ARM CPU project. It is part of another growing list of companies doing now their own custom CPUs in the hyperscaler world. So now Amazon, Google, and Microsoft make their own ARM-based CPUs. Google's is called Axion. And obviously, very, very similar strategy to Amazon and Microsoft is that it's designed to run really the cloud-based workloads, some of the software stack from Google. But, you know, Google's now got a CPU. They've got a training accelerator. Actually, interesting, they noted that the new Gemini model they had was completely trained on their TPUs, which, again, makes sense. They control that stack. But obviously, eating their own dog food was point A of proving that strategy. But, you know, another point for the world of custom, all three hyperscalers now kind of doing more than just one accelerator ASIC, but now CPUs. And I doubt that it stops there. Another one, Facebook, the second version of their accelerator, which never was disclosed, but I think we have enough good information. This is a RISC-V-based processor. Their prior one was a RISC-V-based processor, and this sounds like an update to that. But again, you read Facebook's blog, it says, designed for Facebook's AI workloads. So you've got kind of this continuing theme, which is, we run AI workloads, we want to design silicon uniquely, specifically for those AI workloads, which sort of continues that trend. And then another one being Marvell had an AI day this week where they touched on, it was kind of AI as a whole, what they're doing in accelerators, what they're doing with custom projects as well. They announced another big hyperscaler that they're doing custom work for. Anybody tracking Marvell knows that they do a lot of quasi-ish custom, not fully custom, semi-custom based work, but they're adding another big customer there, which is interesting. So all of our listeners will know we've talked on custom at length. We've talked about why companies do it, why it's strategic, why it makes sense sometimes that they double down on these strategies. But this week was another big week on people going a little bit more vertical in their stacks, and kind of this custom trend continues. So interesting overviews there. I know Jay, you've got maybe some evolved thoughts on the custom world since perhaps some prior episodes, but it's getting crazy. It's like everybody seems to continue on a roll their own, but you know, I think we've acknowledged some of those challenges, but what was your take on those news items this week?
So I would also add, Intel had its event, and we touched on it a little bit last week as we recorded on Monday while I was at the event, but there was a lot of confusion about what we could talk about and what was NDA and what wasn't. So I didn't actually touch on any of the actual announcements, most prominent of which is the launch of Gaudi 3, their accelerator. And so it's interesting. We had a whole bunch of companies announce accelerators, some internal, some catalog, and then you had Marvell talking about how they're supporting all that. I would say the most interesting of all the news this week, I think, you know, again, not surprised, but Google's Axion looks very interesting. TPU-5, not a surprise. We kind of knew about that, but the fact that they're using it for training, I think, was very significant because that's the first major model builder, foundational model builder out there that's not using NVIDIA for training, although I think Google's still using some NVIDIA. I thought that was pretty significant. And I would say my favorite fact of the week is that Meta, they named their accelerator something very, very basic, like the meta accelerator. Like, just they didn't come up with a fancy name for it, and I thought that was I enjoyed that. All these fancy names, Trainium and Inferentia and TPU, and Google's just like, yeah, this is our accelerator. Or Meta's like, this is our accelerator. Doesn't have a name. I thought that was pretty, you know, for the most consumer facing company of the bunch, they were pretty. They turned down the marketing for this one, which I appreciated. But, you know, overall, it's like it was a pretty, like, you know, each one of those, like, again, we knew all of this was in the works. It wasn't a surprise. But it's a whole lot of acceleration getting launched this week. Yeah. And I think that's significant. I mean, there's so much momentum here. I know a few months ago when Microsoft announced their accelerator, it was noteworthy that it was designed before ChatGPT. And just looking back, I think TPU-5 was definitely, the Meta one probably was too. But what that tells me is that all of these companies are in very early days. This is all, you know, generation one, except for Google, this is all generation one of their accelerators. I guess Gaudi, Intel's Gaudi is generation two or three, but it's the others are still very early days in this. And I think what we've seen in the market, what we should expect is that when companies announce something, their first version of it, the extent to which they actually deploy it may be pretty limited, unless it's really phenomenal. We don't have benchmarks on a lot of this stuff, but for a lot of these companies, this is just their first attempt and they're going to make a few and test it out. But I would be surprised if all of them end up in massive clusters. I think this is just them dipping their toe in the water.
Right. Well, and what's interesting is there's a difference between, you know, like what a TPU is, for example, or what the accelerator, the AI accelerator in Microsoft's, so Maya, what that is. And then similarly, you know, what some other vendors are doing in terms of very, very specific accelerators for AI versus a product like the CPU from Google or Cobalt from Microsoft or Graviton from Amazon, which is designed to have a outside party run an instance on. So there's a difference between I've made something, I'm going to hope my customers see value in that and then run instances on my silicon versus these accelerators that are just accelerating. I don't know if we really understand all of what they're doing because they're probably not going to tell us, right? I don't expect Microsoft to give us a deep dive on Maya and say, yeah, this is what we're doing. These are what we're accelerating. Or we obviously understand what TPUs do. And to some degree, some people can train on those TPUs, but obviously there's a lot of workloads. And then for Meta, it's the same thing, right? We don't really know. So I sort of see those as a whole lot more self-serving than say, you know, a Graviton, an Inferentia, a Trainium, Cobalt. Because again, right, that's not necessarily for Microsoft workloads. Those are general purpose CPUs that they're hoping you find value, whether that's performance, cost, you know, lower power energy. So I kind of view those things differently. I think I struggle a little bit more still with the really, really why is somebody going to choose a custom instance from one of these companies versus a third party, you know, from a merchant silicon, but I fully understand what they're doing in the AI accelerator. So I guess I put those in two kind of different buckets is how I think about what they're doing in custom. And I lean toward, I think, and I understand that these accelerators for your workloads make sense. I do understand what they're doing in the CPU thing, but I'm really skeptical. Like I want to know what are customers doing it? What benefits are they saying? What's the, like, they don't give us enough customer information to know, are those really being run at scale or not?
Yeah. And it's weird because there's no consistent pattern on, if you think about Amazon, I would argue that Graviton has been very successful, right? In attracting third party workloads, like customers use Graviton. And in part, that's because Amazon priced it that way, but they could afford to. But I think they've definitely use the price performance lever to get people onto Graviton. But by the same token, pun maybe intended, by the same token, their accelerators are not very successful. Trainium and Inferentia just don't. I don't think they've gotten much, if any, third party adoption. People don't go to AWS to use those. They go to AWS to get NVIDIA instances. And they're moving. AWS is moving very slowly with their versions of it. And I understand that the market's moving fast, and they probably have to redesign stuff. But it's interesting. Like their accelerators have not been successful. And by contrast, I think Google's TPUs have been very successful for Google. They've talked a lot about how much money they've saved. I mean, billions in CapEx. And I think Meta is going to be in a great position as well with their stuff. But you know, they just had a really good quarter, and you know, you can attribute a lot of that to they got a great deal on A100s three years ago, and it was timed really well. They got a lot of capacity, and it's helped them out a lot. And so I wonder, you know, Facebook confuses me because they took so long to build an accelerator. They've been looking around forever. They've been kicking everyone's tires. They've made previous designs before. Why now? And how serious are they about this? That's going to be the one to watch. Are they really going to stick with it? But I think let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say they know what they're doing. They designed a good chip. That could be really impactful the way that TPU has done wonders for Google.
Right. Well, what gives me some of this, and I know we've talked about this before, in terms of the custom general purpose products. So like you talked about, right? Something like Graviton, something like Cobalt from Microsoft, and now obviously Axiom from Google. Where I struggle is, and maybe I'm wrong in thinking about it this way, that it seems like they need to offer something that's really some vectored advantage to merchant silicon. And I know you pointed it out, right? Maybe it's price, and that's fine. But what are your trade-offs for that price? And I say that because I have very close friends who are in sales, for instance, of instances from, you know, Amazon, Microsoft, et cetera. And, you know, I've talked to them about this, and, you know, they'll tell me, not naming names, but that when they have conversations with customers, there is an acknowledgement that what they're doing in custom is a bit behind the state of the art that's out there from merchant silicon vendors. So it's acknowledged, but you know, again, these are all decisions of trade-offs, right? You're outsourcing workloads for a specific reason. And if you really, it's not a high value workload, so what? Then run it right at low cost, right? Just do the cheapest thing possible. You don't have something you're on a timeline for. It just needs to do its thing, right? Price is what matters. So I get that point. But I keep hearing, you know, yeah, it has its role, but again, it's behind, you know, technologically what merchant silicon is. So I guess I still sort of struggle with, I know you got to balance those trade-offs, but it still hits me like, okay, well, what really are they doubling down on? What really? And then the other thing I have heard from others in the CIO, CSO world that we talk to is they're still very hesitant to be locked into any one solution. And once you're on one cloud, like that hurts multi-cloud. Being custom for one workload for a proprietary CPU architecture kind of hurts what you might want to do in multi-cloud. And a lot of them still view that as a... So it's smart for an Amazon or Microsoft or Google because there's lock-in, but people are kind of sensitive to that lock-in as they're thinking about multi-year cloud deployments. So again, I don't know how much of that is a deficiency or a deferral from those things, but that's just kind of the stuff I hear about that gives me still a little bit of a pause to like, I'm just not clear, you know, at what scale really these custom silicon things really run when some of those underlying dynamics I think still play a factor that I outlined.
Yeah, we tend to lump all these things together, to say the hyperscalers, but there's really a big distinction between the public cloud providers, the infrastructure, the service providers, and the software side of those companies, right? Mm-hmm. Facebook is pure play. They don't do third-party cloud.
Right.
Makes sense that they're going to do an accelerator because they're going to control that stack. Google, when they talked about Axion, I don't know if you picked, if you saw anything. I didn't see anything about it. It looked to me like this is Axion is meant for Google as opposed to GCP, Google Cloud. Right. And I think that's a bias, like that's an ongoing tension within Google is those two sides of the business. Right. And I know they took steps last year to address that. They put the Silicon team inside of GCP, but this one Axion, looks to me a lot like it's for Google as opposed to GCP.
So it is. So I had a note on that actually. So as of today, right now, basically what they say is instances with Google's Axion processor is available for its own workloads and to Google Cloud customers in late 2024. So people will be able to run their instances on it. And I just made a brief note here from the launch. The chipset features 30% better performance than the fastest general purpose ARM-based instances today, 50 to 60% better performance and energy efficiency versus current x86 use cases. So again, that all sounds great. Yes, it's for their workloads. So workspace, right? All the stuff that the Gmail, whatever, the AI they run on those things, you know, cloud workloads, Google backend, great, but they're definitely bringing it to customers. But again, with a version one chip, and then again, I make this point about lock-in just because, you know, we've talked about this. It's hard to do multi-cloud when you lock in. I'm just not sure. You know what I mean? Like, it sounds good. Yes, those are great performance metrics, but I'm just not sure. And in Google's case, you know, unfortunately, they are the third, you know, in market share by a distant third to Amazon and Microsoft. So again, how attractive is that when we just don't quite see? I mean, Amazon obviously with Graviton has the most scale. I don't know anything about Cobalt customers. Maybe Microsoft will give us an update of that, you know, at Build in a couple of weeks. That's why I make the point. I'd like to know what these customers are doing with it. Are they seeing the value? And is the trade-offs that they've made to run on these custom public cloud instances really worth it, right? And that's, we don't hear much about that. We just hear what they're doing and not a lot of the rubber meets the road, like here's how it's working for the market kind of conversation.
Yeah, the problem is compounded by Google's not great about product consistency. And so it could very well be that they intend to put Axion into production for GCP customers,
right?
But that never actually happens. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if the design team didn't actually have a conversation with the GCP team that they supposedly work for.
Right.
That's Google. It wouldn't surprise me if, like, we can't figure it out what their strategy is because they don't actually have a strategy yet. Yeah, Microsoft, you're right. That's the interesting one because they really have solid use cases on both sides too. Like, I could see them just using it for their own purposes. It could be a very good customer. It could be good big benefit for them. But
so the other thing I wanted to point out too, because I read this and this is slightly reading between the lines, just from some supply chain chatter that I get. But the point about Marvell, what they're doing in this hyperscaler and this custom thing, there's actually a couple of nuggets that suggest, and I say this because I didn't know this, but there's some nuggets that suggest they are, that some of their custom efforts are actually very similar to just IC design services from that of AI Chip and Global Unichip, who we've mentioned before, who are doing a lot of the custom work for some of the other vendors, including Amazon and Microsoft. So I knew when we've talked to Marvell about this, that semi-custom was heavily kind of on the networking side. I didn't know there was more CPU, custom CPU designs that were happening there, but it sounds like that's how the language is coming off in a way that they're also doing some of this, just kind of custom IC design, like the others I mentioned from Taiwan, which is interesting, right? And that's a whole nother lens of custom to understand Marvell than just in many of the same ways we've talked about MediaTek, where MediaTek said, hey, we'll make stuff for you. You know, we'll use our design services. It sounds like Marvell is actually doing that with some current customers who are buying networking from them, which is actually a positive, I think, in terms of a growth story. But I didn't know they were kind of doing that full design service element of it to the degree that it sounds like they're doing it.
The Marvell analyst AI event was interesting. It was, very much intended to be an investor facing event.
Right.
And the investors did not like it.
They did not.
The stock was off 5%. It's off 5% on the day. It was, there was a lot of amorphous criticism. Like I heard you pointed out a few things. I saw a few other things. Like people just weren't happy with it for lots of different reasons. And I think part of the concern is that, as we've discussed, custom is not a great business. If you're a catalog semi company, it's non-recurring. It doesn't necessarily scale. Mm-hmm. You get a design now, doesn't mean you get the next version of that chip.
Exactly.
And their argument is that, this is actually neutral to margin. It's corporate average margins, right? But if you really peel apart the conversation, what Matt, the CEO, was saying was, over time, the custom side of the business will get to the same operating margins as their corporate average. That's good, because that means you're not in the same boat as GUC or some of the other companies in Taiwan, which are right. Pretty low value add, right?
You get
Marvell gross margins or operating margins are pretty good. The problem was, he actually said it takes time, which means you need scale, and this business is there's no cyclicality, there's no self-reinforcing cycle that's going to help you. You get this business, you're going to get more. That doesn't occur in custom. And Marvell does a really good case. They spend a lot of time explaining why they're differentiated, what all the things they bring to the table in custom. I just don't think the street appreciated it or bought it.
Right.
And so that's a challenge for them. Right. It's just it's where they are.
Yep.
I have a whole other thesis about Marvell and things that they could be doing better. I like them. I think they have a lot of really smart people. I just, like many on the street, I question their long-term strategy here.
Yeah. So let's shift gears and kind of talk about another thing that's been interesting to watch with many of these releases that everybody comes out with these days, right? So there's these days, like you said, kind of positioned as investors, but some people take from Broadcom had one a couple weeks ago, maybe last month. Marvell just had theirs, even as a part of like Google stuff. When everybody's talking about this, they all like to take a stab at sizing the market. And you look at some of these things and it's like, yeah, it's going to be $14 billion today. And then by 2028, it's going to be $180 billion. Or some number, right? And we're going to capture 30% of that as our CAGR grows from 10% of custom or of data center revenue to like, I always read these things and I'm like, nah, it's looks great on paper. You're probably vastly overshooting. And I see these things. I'm like, most of these companies have no good way to size this market. It's a shot in the dark, like most forecasts are. But I understand that they're doing it to try to say, we took our best shot to size the market. We hope that leads lift to the way in which you value us. Totally understand. But some of these things feel kind of ridiculous, honestly, because you look at some of these numbers and you're like, oh, really? So all of a sudden, people have all this money to spend and the market can grow 4x in 4 years. Like, I know that's not really happened before, and I get that AI is great, but you also got to spend money on software. You also got to spend money on hiring and growing. It's not like these companies are all just completely made of cash. So anyway, I see these and I'm always entertained. And I had some jokes with some friends on the buy side on Twitter. We were also like, yep, we're taking the under. We're taking the under. We're taking the under, like time and time again. But I get it, right? If you come with a conservative approach, that doesn't look so good, right? I mean, when you're trying to talk to investors. But I have a hard time believing many of these forecasts will be even remotely correct in 3 to 4 years.
It's to the point now, whenever I hear a company talk about TAM for AI, I get Dr. Evil vibes, right?
Yes. Ooh, $1 trillion.
The TAM is $20 billion.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Sharks with laser beams. That's what we need. But you and I were talking about this. It reached sort of the peak of absurdity on AMD's last earnings call when half the questions were trying to pick apart Lisa Su's TAM estimate. And it was like everyone was like so focused on that. And it was my interpretation of what her comments were. It was like she didn't really believe the TAM numbers either. It doesn't really affect her day-to-day life. She's got, yeah, you know, a million other problems. And the minutia of like a 5-year, 10-year estimate on TAM are very abstract when you're, you know, dealing with real issues today. Like, is the product going to ship on time? And
right,
do we have enough parts? There's one person out there who has a real model for this market, right? Dylan Patel at SemiAnalysis has a real model for the size of this market. And his model is, you know, probably cost $500,000 because it's hard to build and it's very valuable and lots of people are interested in it. And I haven't seen it, but I suspect that it does not get to the TAM numbers that everyone else is talking about.
Yeah. Well, and I think the problem is, and we've talked about this before, right? That from a foundry standpoint, from a wafer standpoint, most foundries are fairly conservative in their capacity because they know that the second they go to overcapacity, margins get hit. And the worst thing you can have, right, is a fab that's less than, what, 80% full, right, give or take. So you look at these numbers that they're saying and you come back and you say, okay, so first of all, we've got to have the wafers to make these numbers. And those foundries are not looking at your growth projections and saying, yeah, man, we're going to absolutely scale up to meet that number of wafers because it's just going to run dry. Just too risky,
right,
to run dry, right? And right, so no foundry takes that approach. But then you see these – and that's why – and I would have to imagine because I've talked to Dylan about this too is he has a pretty good wafer capacity model. I built one too. I'm sure it's not as good as his. But the reality is once you know how many wafers can be made and you got a good estimate of size of those chips, you know how many they can produce for different customers with some cost structures built in. But at the end of the day, you have to be certain that how many wafers are we going to need for that market to be, let's just again say, 180 trillion, right, in additional semi spending for CapEx and infrastructure from where it is today. That's a lot of wafers. And those foundries are not building that scale right now. And it's not going to be that number of wafers to meet that number in 2028. But again, I understand a reasonable approach is doesn't look as good to your stock market, right, for you to undercall. And people will probably forgive you for being wrong because you could list a bunch of reasons why you didn't grow 4X, right, over 4 years if that happens. So anyway. Points of challenge, points of confusion.
Yeah. I mean, 5 years from now, are we really going to – is anyone going to dig up these TAM numbers
None.
And go, oh, you were off?
They'll like be zero. Off in like no 8 months. People won't care anymore. So you can just throw it out there and say whatever.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah.
But yes.
I will say there was one presentation at Intel Vision. Like this is 2 days of keynotes. And it was all like an immense amount of AI wash. Everything was AI. And everyone was up there talking about it, very, very big, vague terms about AI. But there was one person gave a talk. It was Naveen Rao from Databricks. He founded Mosaic. He sold it to Databricks. He got up and gave a presentation about like what a transformer is and how it actually works and things that Mosaic is doing to make models more economical, right? And it's interesting because his purpose of his company is to sort of reduce the cost of training. That's kind of what they're specialized in, right? They go to an enterprise and say, you don't need to build a trillion parameter model. We'll help you do it with 70 billion or 60 or less, right? And so he's someone who's thinking a lot about the size of models and the compute need for it. But he actually made a really strong case why we need a lot more silicon. Now, admittedly, he was at an Intel event, and so he was trying to pump up everyone to buy more silicon. But he actually laid out the numbers and made a pretty good case for why if you know we have the capacity to do a lot more with large language models and large vision models and whatever comes next, right? There's still massive gains to be had to do more than just sort of ChatGPT level stuff. But in order to do that, we're going to need a very large build out. But that's like one person out there who's actually making that case. Everything else is there's a lot of fluff percolating out in the world today.
Yeah, agreed. And to your point about like everybody, because I'm sure you get this question too, and I don't want to go through this effort. I just tell every, you know, I think we should just tell everybody to go buy Dylan's. But nobody has sized this market well, and I think that's why they keep picking apart these models, because they're like, how'd you get there? And then the company won't really tell them how they got there. They're very vague on it. And so, but everybody wants one of these models so that they can try to figure out really what's the growth TAM here, right? Is it going to be, is Jensen right? Not just $1 trillion now, but $2 trillion of data center infrastructure is up for grabs, because that number has doubled in maybe 6 months of commentary. So those are the things that I look at to sort of say, okay, high demand. Everybody wants to understand this, but it's so hard. Like, it's predicting this is going to be so hard. And especially because you also have to then, to the foundry point, like we said, really deal and deal with your wafer supply and order up. And that's why forecasting really matters. If you're really wrong and you're building for that number, it could be an absolute disaster.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really good point, because like the TSMC is not going to, well, I don't know how they're going to plan this all out, but it's like, I'm sure they're not going around asking semiconductor CEOs what the TAM is. They're doing it at a much more granular, lower level. And I mean, I've worked when I was on the street for a long time. I used to get calls from some of the foundry operators and certainly some of the semicap equipment WFE makers, who are all trying to build TAM models for whatever market. And this is back in mobile and PC, we're driving everything. And they didn't have the best models. I'll tell you right now, like, I don't want to pick on them, but like a company like Applied Materials, I used to talk to them occasionally, and we would compare notes, and we would be way off. Like, I knew mobile and they would be way off on mobile. And it must be really, really scary to be in that business. It's super cyclical, long lead times, and have to contend with a whole lot of noise in the system about what actual demand is going to be. Because you think about it, if you're TSMC or you're ASML or AMAT, you're really, really far from the end user, right? You're 5, 6, 7 steps removed from the end user. And so you have really, really poor visibility. And right now, everybody loves WFE as a category because you just feel like demand is going to go through the roof forever. But you and I both know at some point that will taper off, and the stocks won't be darlings then. But that point is still probably, it's still potentially many years away. Maybe. Who knows?
Yeah. Agreed. Okay. So let's return back now and sort of tie this together to the broader sort of custom conversation that we've been having. So everybody's, I mean, you could argue trying to limit their dependency on an outside vendor, whether that's an x86 vendor or a GPU vendor named NVIDIA. Does more and more and more and more of these companies continue to go custom really, really pose a kind of threat to NVIDIA? Like, should the deepening of this custom trend and more of the cloud hyperscalers, and I know Jensen said we're not just entirely dependent on the cloud hyperscalers, but right now those cloud hyperscalers are the ones buying a ton of GPUs year over year, is there anything about this that suggests something structurally about NVIDIA that could cause concern?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You think about it, they had two of their largest customers this week announced that they were building competing products, which I think for a normal company would be concerning, right? Especially you have, 10 customers or so, or 50, 60% of data center revenue. And data center revenue is everything for NVIDIA right now. So you just lost, 20% of your addressable market, your serviceable market. The stock didn't really react that way. I don't think I don't think the market, the street, is that concerned at this point. I certainly don't think NVIDIA is too concerned, because there's still, there's still a lot of things working in their favor. We talked about this 2 weeks ago. A lot of this is moving in their right. It was 2 weeks ago. We talked about all the things that could go wrong for NVIDIA, and we kept saying the biggest threat for them, and both in hardware and software, is, you know, the customers start to move their own, go their own way. And I think there's two counters to that. One is there are lots of other customers coming on stream. All the enterprises want to do AI, and it doesn't look like they're in a big hurry to use anyone else's silicon. And that's why we were just talking a minute ago, like, you know, Axion and TPU aren't really ready for external customers. Trainium and Inferentia aren't getting anywhere with customers. The broad enterprise space still wants to use NVIDIA. And NVIDIA is doing a lot of things with their software to ensure that people who are building models today have all these tools and all these resources coming from NVIDIA. Once that's built, you know, 5-6 years from now, they're not going to move off of those tools. Like, they build their foundational models on NVIDIA pre-built models. It's unlikely that they're going to shift off NVIDIA silicon. So there are lots of reasons the broad enterprise is going to stick with NVIDIA, I think. Which means that the public cloud providers, Amazon, Azure, GCP, are still going to need a lot of NVIDIA for those customers. And the other thing too is, like I said, is other than Google's TPUs, none of these other accelerators, these competing accelerators, are terribly sophisticated or terribly advanced or mature, I guess is the right word. So maybe that changes over time, but Amazon sort of proves that it's not an automatic. And so I think NVIDIA is okay, but I think it definitely is a bit telling to me, though, that they are so heavily leaning on these AI factories, these independent data center operators like CoreWeave, to run GPU-centric data centers. That's an interesting tool for NVIDIA, because they can always, it's a little bit of negotiating leverage. It gives them a little bit of negotiating leverage against the big hyperscalers. It's a double-edged sword, because when things go bad, those AI factories are going to be a bleeding sore. But it is an interesting dynamic, and if you sort of forecast it forward, there's lots of different ways that can play out. So, long story short, I think NVIDIA is doing just fine.
Yeah.
For the foreseeable future.
Agreed, and that's why I think anybody who's caught Jensen's sort of impassioned commentary about competition, and he's addressed the elephant in the room in custom and said how expensive it is, and especially even expensive in desert, because tape outs are, you know, in the double digit, sometimes triple digit millions of dollars. It's and in fact, what did he say? I think he said with Blackwell that's the result of like $10 billion of R&D or something like that. Yeah. He's making the point to say, you know, this is really, really hard, and it's really, really expensive to be state of the art. And you have to be able to return that, you know, as an ROI, and especially to keep continuing and keep progressing there. So it is a fascinating angle, and it is one I'm sure he hears, which is why I bring it up, right? Does this really impact the full thesis? And we mentioned it also in our holistic analysis of NVIDIA episode a few weeks ago. I know he's sensitive to it, but that's why I come back to the, how do you make a trade-off about where you want to run these workloads when one vendor who's a merchant vendor might be a little bit more expensive, but might get it done at either higher quality or faster, right? If this is a workload that you value and you need it immediately, training a model, you know, et cetera. There's just fascinating dynamics people are going through. And I know, you know, back to a number of these folks in IT that I've talked to who are working to deploy where they want to run these cloud workloads, AI has really thrown a lot of this into a whole new set of analysis for them, because they are trying to figure out, do I want to outsource all of this? First question, do I want to outsource it, just part of it to one cloud and part of it to another? Or do I want to go all in with just one provider? Like, they really are struggling with this, because it seemed like when we were just talking about basic cloud workloads, not these super intense AI ones, their strategy was a little bit more clear about who and why they were working with. And now this has changed a lot. And I just find that a fascinating dynamic about so many more choices they have about AI outsourcing their workloads and running these workloads on different products. They don't have an answer. Like, they don't know either. So it's like, I talk to them. I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, then we're not going to know. So clearly no clarity of the direction this is going, because they're still trying to figure all this out.
Yeah. And I think that's the ultimate question behind all of this is, does the rise of AI shift not only the fortunes of the semiconductor industry, but of the broader cloud industry, right? Because if enough of those kinds of customers say, you know what, working with Amazon is too expensive, they don't have the allocation, I'm going to go to CoreWeave or another dozen of these guys, and I'm going to go to Grok, and I'm just going to work in inference as a service as one of my DevOps flows, and I don't really care about the provider, or I'm getting a better deal for this major case of workload, that in theory is a pretty significant, it's probably the first significant threat we've seen to the hyperscalers in a long time. And I don't think they view it that way. I don't get the sense that any of these companies are really, really scared about losing their public cloud business. And maybe that's rightfully so. It's a pretty remote risk that happens, but I think there's enough changing in the industry that it's worth considering that there is that real possibility, right? Certainly for someone like Google, who's always sort of GCP is like you said, it's a distant third. This is a company that is not consistent with their product strategy. Does it just get to the point where they're competing so hard and spending so much money trying to get third-party customers onto AI workloads, and those customers don't want TPU, they want
right
B100 or B200? Does Google at some point just throw in the towel on GCP? And I think if I were an IT manager, a CIO, I would be worried about that.
Yep. Right. Yep. Agreed. And one of the things that I think will be super interesting, because what I just said is not like a microcosm of a number of people that I've talked to, but if you look at any number of CIO reports that's come out, you sort of hear the same thing. The vast majority of them have projects around AI, trying to figure out what to do with their workloads. They have not made those deployment decisions yet, let alone anything at scale. At some point, you're going to see a whole host of enterprises make a move. We have no idea which way. We literally no idea. But at some point, you're going to see that happen. And everything could change, to be honest with you. Like, who's in the lead, who's not in the lead, whether it's custom, whether it's like, it could all happen quickly. And no one is anticipating, like, once the businesses start deploying at scale, the impact that's going to have on the market. So when that happens, this will be a very interesting rush. I don't know when, but I keep thinking about that. And I'm like, man, everything we're talking about today could absolutely be wrong in 12 months.
I say that to myself pretty much every day, every time I publish a post. But yeah, point taken.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's what makes this interesting, right? That's what makes AI interesting.
Yeah. Right? Very dynamic. And we're at the cusp of something. We and our podcast are at the very beginning of something. And a lot's going to change and catalog. And we're wrong about 80 or 20%, Jay. We just don't know what 20%. That's what I'm going to say.
20%. Oh, you're an optimist. All right. I'll take those numbers.
Yeah, I'll take it. I like saying I'm going to be 80% right. All right. Good stuff. Thanks for listening, everybody, to us ramble and share our thoughts on the industry and what's happening. And stay tuned for next week's episode. And again, a number of guests that we have coming that will be very exciting, some high profile, some maybe entertaining. We'll see. And in the next few months. So keeping it mixed up with some guests. So thanks for listening, and have a great week.
Thank you, everybody. Tell your friends.